Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 93 of Season 10 of Movie Around Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Niall McGowan of the Bat Minute. Welcome back once again, Niall.
Pity.
Just stay clear of the third rail.
Yeah. Rather than being on another episode of the show, I've decided to take myself out in what's a pretty gruesome manner as well. Like, that's not even like a, you know, shooting yourself in the head would have been one thing, but like, oh yeah, I'm gonna do this.
Exactly.
Very memorable part of the film. But yeah, genuinely remember when I first saw it, been like, what? But hey, we'll get to that now.
We will discuss that.
Yeah. I have some questions for you though, Rob. Now, because this I was going to bring it up last minute as well.
In a minute or after?
No, I think we could, because we're right at now what Mr. Blue does to himself. But I did some research into New York City's history with executions.
Ooh, okay.
Because of course,
I did a little bit of research too. So does that mean I have to put my turn my paper over? Is that what the idea is here?
Oh, maybe we can both get into it. Because I looked into both the last execution in New York, because they of course mentioned over the course of these 2 minutes, like, do you still execute people in the state? And like, oh, executions? No, no. Yeah, so I looked into the, like, when was the last one? It was very recent to this. But I also looked into the first execution as well, which you can trace back. Because apparently I didn't realize that New York basically invented the electric chair. Like, it was invented in New York City. Which I thought it must have been a thing. Like, oh, it's probably throughout Europe or something like that. And then it just was adapted elsewhere. But no, apparently it was 1881 in Auburn County, or Auburn State or County Prison in New York, apparently. So, but what have you looked into, Rob? I don't want to step on your toes.
No. Go ahead. Keep giving your information. You're good.
Okay. So I'll go in for the last one. The last guy to be executed was a fellow called Eddie Lee Mays, and he's one of those ones. It's a weird thing, because, you know, I'm dealing with Batman in, you know, for so long that we him and Hall were like, what, you know, how appropriate Batman's actions are coming in and, like, you know, breaking people's legs and smashing people in the head for, you know, a lot of them are like poverty stricken criminals who are like, oh, maybe they don't have anywhere else to go, and you feel like sometimes you feel a bit guilty about it and stuff like that. And then looking at Eddie Lee Mays is like, oh, the last guy to be executed in Sing Sing. On Old Sparky, as they used to call it. And you look at him, it's like, oh, he's a bad guy. He's a bad, bad guy. Like, literally, multiple murders over several years. And then kept slashing people. It mentions in his Wikipedia page, it's always like, he would slash a man for an argument, and then two paragraphs later, he slashed another man for an argument. It's like, this dude loves slashing people. What the hell is going on here? But yeah, eventually then he was involved in a robbery. They got a lot of people in a bar to sort of just empty out their stuff. There was a lady who apparently was going too slowly. And then when she opened her purse, she had nothing in there. So he just put his gun to her head and just shot her straight in the face. And then there was him and Han over his trial, et cetera, et cetera. And then he was like, no, I want to be, like, I'd rather be executed than have to, you know, spend life in prison, or, you know, whatever amount of time in prison I'm going to have to spend. And so he opted for execution. He's 24 years old, which is insane. And yeah, he was Eddie Lee Mays in 1963, was the last person to be executed by Old Sparky, because it was then afterwards it was deemed unconstitutional to execute people in the state of New York, anyway, at least. So yeah, he was the... he was the last one, which, so that's only, what, 11 years before Pelham 1-2-3?
Mm-hmm.
Or probably, yeah. Or maybe probably 10 years by the time they're filming, maybe. So maybe that's why, like, you know, it's still so fresh in the air for Blue. He's coming over. He's just like, oh, I've traveled all this way to see one of your famous New York executions. I understand you invented the electric chair here as well.
That's right. You'd think that he would have done that. He would know what's going on with that. I don't know why.
Yeah, I would have been down to like, if I get caught, I will not be going to prison. So I better make sure that's, you know, that they're actually executing people rather than. But no, he finally takes that gambit. But yeah, as I mentioned earlier, I've also researched the first one, which occurred in 1881. The electric chair haven't been invented. Oh, sorry, no, the execution itself took place in 1888, and the electric chair was invented by a dentist who apparently worked for the New York. He was on the city council board or something. But a dentist came up with the concept of the electric chair, apparently. And then in 1888, they decided to put it to good use after all this time, invented, you know, put this thing, tested it out on a horse. And that worked quite successfully. which is, I don't know if they're like, are they putting the horse in the chair? Or are they just like, oh, you can electrocute a horse to death. So now we know that works. But I can't imagine them like, well, they sitting it down and then strapping it in, and like, what? How did they test it on a horse? That doesn't make any sense to me. And also, too, like, I feel, because I think their whole thing was that they believed it was going to be more humane than hanging, because hanging can obviously go wrong. You're betting on the neck snapping instantly, and then people have been taken out that way. But of course, that can go wrong very easily. People's neck can break, and it doesn't kill them, and they're just left there. You could be there for minutes, strangling to death. And the whole concept of an execution via electric chair is that like you should immediately go into like a cardiac arrest and like shock, so it'll be more of a peaceful death that you just like you won't even really feel it happening and stuff. And so the first guy that got to come up for the chair was a guy called William Kemmler, and it notes that despite it being successful on this horse, his execution did not go smoothly. Apparently like he had murdered his wife basically, and he did have remorse, and he came in and he's just like, you know, apparently like it seems as if all the guards and stuff really liked him. They were very good luck, William, all this kind of stuff as they're setting him up. And as they were getting him exhorted, he was like, oh, I'm in no rush, don't you know, take your time, etc., etc. And then when they strapped him in, they gave him 1,000 watts. And then, you know, we've all seen the Green Mile. They're just, yeah, there you go, let it ride. And then 1,000 watts. There's no mention of the sponge. They do mention they had to shave part of his head and then put on the metal apparatus. But the Green Mile does come in here, because that murder, like that execution without the sponge, is basically what ended up happening to him. Because 1,000 watts went, and they're like, came over. They're like, apparently the witnesses said like he's still breathing, and they're like, oh Christ, yeah, he is, he's still alive. Give him 2,000 watts. You have to go, and they were like, do it. You have to do it straight away, because obviously he's going to be in horrible, horrible pain. And then apparently, yeah, 2,000 watts, and witnesses said that he set on fire. Basically, they're saying that the blood vessels and his, you know, around his face and stuff and throughout his body started bursting, and it was just bleeding everywhere. And they said like the smell was just absolutely unbearable, and it was, you can tell Stephen King clearly read this somewhere in some history book and was like, have I got an idea for a scene, and then threw that into the Green Mile. And apparently after that they were instantly, because you know, back in the day this was covered in the press, so like, hey, we got, well, I suppose they still would do that now if we're coming up with new methods for execution, they'd be like, hey, let's see how this thing went. But apparently, yeah, the press the next day were like, this was a disaster. This is the worst, most horrific way of killing someone, would be to electrocute them to death. But for whatever reason, they decided to keep doing it. And I guess they refined the process to being like, yeah, you can kind of get it down to what it's supposed to be. But yes, the first death by electric chair was in New York itself in 1888. Apparently it came up, it was a whole, there's a lot of, there was basically wars going on between two. Like it got involved in the War of the Currents, because it's like the plan to carry out Kemmler's execution via electric chair drew the situation into the AC/DC War of the Currents between George Wrestling House and Thomas Edison. In the ultimate incarnate, the power of the electric chair, a current standard adopted by a committee after a demonstration performed at Edison's laboratory by anti-AC activist Harold P. Brown, showing AC's lethality, was supplied by a Westington generator surreptitiously acquired by Brown. This had led to Westinghouse trying to stop what seemed to be Brown and Edison's attempt to try to portray the AC used in Westington's electrical system as the deadly executioner's current. Supporting Kemmler's appeal by hiring a lawyer to represent him, the appeal failed, and the U.S. Supreme Court turned down the case on the grounds there was no cruel or unusual punishment in death by electrocution. So that's where the creation of the electric chair drawing the ire of Thomas Edison himself, a patent apparently in there. So but just thought it was all interesting.
Most
that,
definitely.
Such a history with the city itself, and then but Mr. Blue decides to do himself. It's like, oh, I guess that's quite apt for a guy choosing to execute himself in New York. It's like, hey, the home of the electrocution, I guess. But yeah, I remember the scene really shaking me at the time, because it was just like, oh wow, that's it. And you can see Garber's reaction when he sticks the foot on the third rail. You know, you feel every second of Matthau's. It's like, ugh! Like it's because absolutely how awful that would be is the way to go.
Again, Mr. Blue forgot to put a sponge on as he was doing that. But we'll get there.
Yeah.
You mentioned your information about the death penalty. Now I wanted to mention mine.
I was worried that I just stolen your information.
Yeah,
but you got more stuff. All right.
You actually talked about stuff that I wasn't even going to talk about. So that works really well. I was going to talk about in general. how many states in 2025, how many of the U.S. 50 states still have capital punishment? And that they, and one second.
2025, it's got to be like two.
Where they still carry out executions, because there are five different categories. There are states that have repealed or never had capital punishment. There are states that have capital punishment, but they formally suspended executions. There are states which have it in in their laws, but it's never been needed to execute anyone in the last 10 years. There is one state where it's in the laws, but it's been informally suspended. And then the fifth category is that there are states which have it in their laws, and they have executed people within the last 10 years. So that's the last category is the one I'm asking about.
Okay.
How many of the 50 states still have capital punishment in its stature and have executed people over the last 10 years?
I feel like I almost feel guilty in saying it, but I imagine it's like one, and it's just Texas would be.
No,
that would be the
answer is actually 16. There are 16 states that still have it.
16 states.
So you have Arizona, Utah, Texas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, South Dakota, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Tennessee, Indiana, and Florida. The federal government also still has capital punishment laws, and that it also is, they have killed people over the last 10 years. Which again is one of the reasons why, again, we're not getting into politics here, but the whole story from a few months back with Charlie Kirk that happened in Utah, and therefore it's a question, that is a state that does have capital punishment. So the question is, what is going to happen with that? There is one state which has capital punishment in its laws, but it's been informally suspended, and that's Ohio. Then you have four states which have it in their laws, but in the last 10 years, they haven't executed anybody, and that would be Nevada, Idaho, Wyoming, and Kansas. Then you have six states which have capital punishment in its laws, but they formally suspended them, and that's California, Oregon, Montana, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and North Carolina, and then you have 23 states which have officially either suspended, repealed, sorry, they've either repealed or never instituted, and New York is one of those 23 states that fits in there. Now
Ah.
let's go back into the idea of the methods of death penalty. Okay, so there are 27 states and territories that have the death penalty. You know, whether they use it or not is something else. 23 of them provide a lethal injection as either the sole method of execution or the primary method if the convict doesn't select one. Okay, then there are four states
Yeah.
which provide electrocution as a primary method, and then you they also allow the Department of Corrections to decide what method they want to use. So yeah, the I mean they used to use the electric
I
chair
mean,
in most states that were dealing with death penalties, and then they changed it to lethal injection. That's more I don't know what to say is more humane or whatever it is. You know, again,
yeah. I feel like the chair is like the least humane. Just, but again, that's from watching The Green Mile and been like, oh, look what can happen. You know, but I do always like the concept of like the a prisoner being able to choose their own method of execution, because I think on it, and that's an I would always be like, oh, can you just do whatever you want? And I'd be like, well, I want to be dropped out of a plane
No,
or something like that. But I'm sure
it's
they
not that
have
you can
like,
say I
no, it
want
has to
to
be
bungee jump,
this,
you know.
this, you know.
Let me jump to my own death. It's the you know there are set methods.
Yeah, I want to be torn apart by a pack of feral wolves or something. Like, no, it has to be. We're giving you a list of things. It has to be. There's like four methods, and
And
you choose one
South
beforehand.
Carolina actually allows the inmate to choose firing squad, and just as of recording, I mean we're you know a little peek behind the curtain. This is mid-November. 5 days ago, someone in South Carolina was executed by firing squad on November 14th.
Wow.
So.
I feel like I would go by fire, but I just like a, I have a a flair for the theatrical, you know. I feel that is like I would want to be there with the blindfold and the cigarette and stuff like that. I would want to go for the full tilt. Like, if you're gonna do it the stereotypical way, please. Come on, you
I
know.
mean, the
But
irony is the guy who was executed for 5 days ago, he himself he fatally shot the three people. So
oh, wow.
yeah, so I guess it's pretty ironic that he would choose to be shot. You know,
Yeah.
he maybe
Anyway, it might
maybe
be
20 maybe 21 years ago when he committed these crimes, he should just let the police shoot him, and that would have saved a lot of time and money.
It's yeah, a bit of kind of like, oh, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So
That's
like,
right.
yeah, of course I want to be. He's just like, I just love shooting people and getting shot. Like, it's my favorite thing.
That's true.
Yeah. It's
Correct.
I feel do we feel oh, have you is there more to the
No, no, no.
to your
That's
fact?
no. I think we've covered it more than efficiently for
Yeah.
what we need to
Cause,
talk about. And
yeah, cuz I didn't want to like cut you off if you're in the middle of
no, that's
yeah.
okay. That's okay.
Yeah.
And so Garber then. Well, actually, you know what? We didn't even. I didn't even introduce this minute. So minute 93 begins with Garber responding to Blue, and ends with the prostitute watching the roller coaster. So, you know, yesterday we ended things with Mr. Blue asking Garber if they still execute, and he goes, "What? Oh, execute?" He goes, "No, not in the moment." And then Blue says, "Pity," and then he just moves his foot a fraction of an inch to the side and electrocutes himself. And they view this quite effectively, the fact that, we see smoke coming out of his jacket, which, if this was a cartoon, if you're looking at it from a cartoon perspective, it looks like, there's smoke coming out of his ears, out of his out of his collar and stuff like that. So they do it in a very interesting way.
It's very effective, I feel, as a, I think Shaw, he sells it, like the kind of the grimace he's given. It's like, it's not too much, but it's like, and it feels like a guy sort of in a state of being stunned, but yeah, it's a really well done. But it's so much just in the mentality of it though, of like, what has Blue been through in the past that he just cannot cope with the idea of going, like, presumably back to a prison. Like, we know he's a, a war mercenary, so perhaps, some of the war zone prisons he's been in have been literal hell, and that's what he's thinking. But like, would prison in New York potentially extradite him back to England as well? You never know. But is it that bad that he just can't even begin to conceive of going there? He's just like, no, I would rather just, and also, I'm not going to give you the satisfaction of being able to say that you got me or whatever if I take myself out, for like, it's an elaborate scheme. I'm sure he would get, like, he did outright murder someone. There was a full tilt execution involved, so it but probably facing life imprisonment for this.
Correct.
But it's so just like final and so definitive, like, yeah, I'm not in this moment now, things have gone wrong. I'm very calmly and collectively going to just delete myself basically from the scenario.
Absolutely.
Is so, I think that was again partly what threw me about it, was just like, he's so cool about it, and then he's just like,
It's funny that you
okay,
say he's so cool
and
about it.
he just
He's not
goes and does
cool,
it.
he's hot.
Oh well. But his, his demeanor is
Yes.
but it's yeah, it's a it really it's a fa the way he's played, and the fact we know so little about him, and that he's willing to do this, makes Mr. Blue such a fascinating character to me. Because you're just like, what has this guy been through? What is his mentality? Like, I would 100% take a Mr. Blue prequel just to understand this dude, and like how he got to this point of being like, yep, I'm not interested in being imprisoned by Walter Matthau. Like, I'm just gonna take the easy way out and kill myself in this exact moment.
Exactly. But again, I think maybe it's that he's scared of Marcellus Wallace and knows that if he goes to prison, he's going to be killed anyway, so he might as well just end it on his own right now.
I thought also, I always got a vibe too that there's a little bit of a he's all about like dignity, this guy too, because he could try, he could have tried, he could have just murdered the cop. And then probably got Garber shooting him in the back, which would be undignified. And it also be a bit too, like, I don't know. It would just seem very haphazard doing things that
Right.
way. But they just sort of formally introduce himself to Garber, basically. And then be like, let's see, do you want any chance of a bribe? No. Do you do executions? Nope. Okay. And then just, there's a dignity in his way of like, I could go through and have my dirty laundry aired everywhere and go through a trial for months and et cetera, et cetera. Or I could try to run and then you'd shoot me anyway, but I'd be running like, like a coward, and trying to get away. But no, it's more dignified for me to just go, like, rather than go endure all that, I'm just gonna, like, I'm taking this situation into my hands. You're not gonna, take my life out of my own hands, basically. And I'm choosing to do this myself because it's the most dignified route, almost.
Right.
But yeah, very, very British stiff upper lip behavior
Very stiff
by
upper
Blue there. So.
lip. And yeah, he just they give us a good 20, 25 seconds of him being zapped, and then he just like collapses and falls. He just falls over, and we see Zach just groaning. And then he goes, Christ.
I do also just like, though, that, because I've not really pointed out that, like, this is your big, this moment gets extrapolated in Die Hard, for instance, of like the two guys that only talked over the radio. They finally come face to face and they have their big cowboy showdown. And, you know, it ends with Hans Gruber going out a window and clinging on to Holly's watch and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, you get like Rathacon, like they never, you know, they only ever talk over the radio and stuff like that. But this is so much more of a realistic and very muted kind of thing of like, there's no, it's not been taken out into like a grandiose vendetta between these two men or anything. It's just Garbers is a guy on the job doing his job. And he shows up and it's just like, there's no like, oh, my arch nemesis moment. It's just like, hey, it's you. And then we actually get the two, the good guy, the good, like the black hat and the white hat of the movie meeting. And then it's just such a sort of like little short interaction between them. I appreciate it. And just like, yeah, they're keeping it dead simple. And it's just like, yeah. And you just know down the line, Garber's going to be like, hey, that guy I met one time. Rather than like, you know, like, oh, that thing in the subway. You know, giving it so much more weight and making him into like, you know, a big boogeyman for him. It's just going to be more like, oh, yeah, there's that guy that one time that he held up the subway track and then I caught him and he killed himself. And yeah, it was a weird afternoon for me, you know?
Yeah, seriously.
Just moves on with his life.
Completely.
Yeah.
But what it basically comes down to is that, you know, Garber's there to go help this female cop because he runs over to the hippie on the ground and goes, and he starts, you know, soothing him, I guess you could say. And he'll say, we'll have an ambulance here in no time, miss. Everything's going to be okay. Which is a great punchline of something that they've been dealing with, you know, they've been toying with throughout the entire movie, you know, about, well, is it a man or a woman, the undercover cop? And, hey, I never thought about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fact that he automatically assumes that it's a female cop because he just sees the long hair is just a very funny punchline.
Honestly, I didn't get it. I thought this was him as Garber being like, he's an old-fashioned guy. And now this was like, I felt this was him kind of quipping because the guy's undercover as a hippie with long hair. So he's going like, oh, we'll have an ambulance right away, miss. Because, you know, Garber would be a kind of guy who wouldn't appreciate long hairs and he wouldn't be into hippies and stuff like that. So it's kind of, I felt it was him having like a little jab at the cop. Almost like a kind of little, you know, like, you know, like in Point Break when like they go through like they bust up Tom Sizemore's undercover operation that he's had going for like a year and stuff. And he's all like, man, do you think I like having my hair like this? Do you think I like looking like this? I've been doing it for this damn case.
That's right.
I kind of felt a bit, almost a thing of this cop and like, you know, having to go undercover with long hair and be like a dirty hippie, basically, you know, no shoes and wearing a poncho probably stinks to heaven. It's like a little bit of humor between them, but like, all right, miss, you know, it was meant to be taken in that way. But no, I never interpreted it as being like Garber just sees the long hair and he's just like, I guess it was a woman the whole time. And stuff.
But again, it's great that this is a joke that's been going on throughout the entire movie. And they just him throwing out that little line, calling just the word miss says that he's come to terms with the fact that it's probably a woman, you know?
Yeah.
It's
like, you know, Blue coming over, been like, are you a policeman or are you a police woman? Like, I'm a man. Like,
right.
Okay, just clarifying that there, because it could have been a woman. So, yeah,
that's right.
The casual sexism of the 1970s throughout the transit police system.
That's right, and then Garber like stands up and just walks away.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
He needs to because he doesn't have a cell phone, but it still makes sense. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Even if he did too down the subway, probably wouldn't get it anyway. So he's like, I gotta go. I can't just hang about, you know, I gotta go back up the and luckily I left that hatch open.
Exactly.
For you know, quick going up there and find like some city workers come along, it's like, ah, who left this open and locked them in? And he's like, oh, god damn it.
Well, no, I'm assuming he's gonna be able to find a phone somewhere in the underground subway system. That's my assumption.
Yeah. He does have the kind of like vibe about Garber though that he would be like, oh Christ, and then you can imagine him trudging for like a mile underground to find a payphone to be like, And he just goes, all the day is work, you know.
Exactly. And then the last 5 seconds of this minute, we get to see the train. Again, this is a great camera shot where basically the camera's in the front of the train, watching the train just speed through. And we see that the prostitute is looking out the window, I guess, sort of enjoying this roller coaster ride, because she's screaming like people scream on roller coasters. So she must be enjoying what's going on.
Oh, I mean, this next minute, there is a great scream. The sex, this whole section coming up now is a really fantastic bit of editing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's all next minute, though.
That's right. So. We'll talk about that tomorrow. All right. Mm. So every Monday, we have a segment called Mathow Monday, where my guests will give their top five Walter Mathau performances. So, Niall, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
I do have to ask, though, as well, because I know it was coming up for Tuesday, but the New Order fan in me has to ask, would you ever attempted to make it Blue Monday so it could be about Mr. Blue, and then you switch the days around?
No, not at all.
Okay, all right. Nope. I just figured, the song Blue Monday is so oversaturated over here. But like, it was my first instance of being like, oh, you go Blue Monday, right? But Mathow Monday, of course, me, you know, and Batman with all the alliteration we do in the Batman intros. I can appreciate
that,
Mathow
Monday. That sort of comes
in. I guess. Yeah. So my top five will be, I'll throw another shout out to a film that's quite enjoyable, even though I'm not entirely sure Mathow's correctly cast in it. A New Leaf, which I mentioned the other day. Have you seen A New Leaf, Ralph? Have you come across it?
Yeah.
So, you know, basically it's a Ghislaine May movie. She like wrote, directed, and stars in it. But basically Walter Matthau is like a millionaire who loses all his money and has to get married, basically, to keep up his lifestyle. He ends up marrying sort of like a, you know, sort of dowdy, unassuming millionaire. Elaine May, and she just, you know, and they gradually genuinely fall in love and stuff. And I really enjoy it as a film. And what Mathau is great in it, but I'm all the entire time when you watch it, you're a bit like, he looks too like a guy who's been through stuff. You know, he has Walter Matthau's whole thing is that he looks like a guy who's been weathered and has been beaten down by the world, basically. So the idea of him playing a pampered millionaire is very like, He's acting it well, but his face belies, you know, a million bad days and a million, you know, walking through snowstorms and rainstorms to, you know, trudge onto a subway with wet shoes and stuff like that. He just has the look of a hangdog guy who's been like through the crap. So I enjoy it as a film, but like I put it last because I'm a bit like, oh, Mathau. You know, Jack Lemmon could have played that part potentially, and I would have bought it more. Or like, I think they wanted Cary Grant, and you're like, of course, Cary Grant. Yeah, that's 100% who you're casting that part. But they went for Mathau instead. Then also, I'll go throw in. You know, it's a bit of a cheat, but like, it's a great movie, and he is in it. I'm throwing in JFK as well. Him and Jack Lemmon, of course, both. It's one of the ones that don't star together, but they are both in it. And I will just, you know, you don't need me to sell JFK to you, but it is a fantastic film.
And I think it's a great role for him also because of the fact that he is just he's playing so much against type there. You know, he's basically playing a corrupt senator there, or a senator who we can assume is corrupt. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, he's a politician in a Oliver Stone film, so the assumption is that he's the worst of the worst. Then I'm going to go put in one that I thoroughly enjoy. But it's not a great film, but it's like, I appreciate its energy, at least. Cactus Flower, one of, you know, Goldie Hawn's first film, where they come up with this amazing sci-fi concept that both Goldie Hawn and Ingrid Bergman are crazy in love for Walter Matthau, which is just like, if you can get past that, like, if you can get past that sort of leap in logic, then it's a really thoroughly enjoyable piece. I'm a big fan of like Frasier, which is a show that's full of like French farce and people lying about situations and things getting really complicated and out of control by people just like needlessly deceiving each other So it gets really convoluted. And that's the entire plot of Cactus Flower. It's just like Walter Matthau is lying about his relationship status for the purposes of sort of sparing Goldie Hawn's feelings. And then it just sprawls into like 90 minutes of everybody's lying to everybody. And then more people get involved. And it gets more and more complicated as it goes on and stuff. And it's great fun. And Walter Matthau, he seems miscast as a spoiled billionaire. But as a schlubby dentist, he's fantastic. And yeah, really, working this right energy of being this guy is just like, yeah, well, an educated, hardworking guy within, it's a very New York film as well. It's very much in New York of the 60s. And then he's great in it, but like the show is kind of stolen by Goldie Hawn, to be fair, because it's her, like, it's like a showpiece for her almost, really. But the two of them have great chemistry and back and forth. So if people haven't seen Cactus Flower, it's out there. It's well worth tracking down. And then number two, I wanted to go for I felt like I needed to do like a Lemon Matthau team up because they work together so often and they were a great duo. And it's kind of like, I'm sure many people will mention The Odd Couple or this one. I've never seen The Front Page. I was going to use it as an excuse to try to track it down for this, actually, because I know His Girl Friday was basically remade with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau as The Front Page. I was like, what? So the thing I've always been curious about, and they did, of course, Grumpy Old Men, all that stuff together. But I'm going to go and give a shout out to another great Billy Wilder movie, The Fortune Cookie, is where Matthau's playing an unbelievably corrupt shyster lawyer, like a proper dodgy, like underhanded, ambulance chaser, basically. And he's, convincing Jack. I'm assuming you've seen The Fortune Cookie, Rob.
Right. So, I mean, this is the one where he won an Oscar for it. So.
Yeah. But like he's the whole back and forth between them of like, Lemon smoothing him into basically playing up an injury so he can make a massive, insurance claim, and he can sue CBS, he can sue blah 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 blah. And because the thing is that he's usually inherently quite likable in the things that he's in. But he's such a smarmy, slimy little git in The Fortune Cookie.
Yeah.
But it's weird too because he's everything he's doing is corrupt and hateful and just looking out for himself. But at the same time, Matthau's got that vibe where you're like, oh, but I kind of want him to succeed, though. Like, I want to see him get away with this. So when he's like, because he's going up against like rich people, he's going up against like big rich lawyers and stuff. Even though what he's doing is immoral and completely wrong, there's something about Walter Matthau that I'm just like, yeah, but I kind of want him to get one over with everybody and him to actually win this incredibly corrupt case he's putting together. So, it's a guy, full-on charm offensive that he's able to win me over, despite his character being so kind of heinous, basically. Fortune Cookie, great, great film. And then my number one is The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. That's every time Walter Matthau's ever mentioned in any scenario, my go-to image of him is the ending of Pelham 1-2-3, where he comes back into the door. I think it's the perfect, storm of everything about his appeal, basically, like his schlubbiness and his doggedness, his hangdog face, but also, like, I love Garber as a character, though, because he has this and that, like, as we mentioned earlier, like, he's a guy who's not, like, he's not a great guy. He's not an action hero. He's not this, paragon of virtue, but he's just a good dude doing his job, mm-hmm. and he's just doing it well. And like the fact that he's just, he's a transit cop. And like, how many times are you going to get like a subway car getting hijacked by people? But he's just like, there's never any trying to defer things over to everyone else. He just goes like, okay. And he just sits down and he deals with this situation right. as best as he can, because that's his job. And you can tell, again, you can extrapolate the fact that it's played by Walter Matthau. He gives you the vibe that he's been through. He's living in 70s New York. He's probably been through some.
Exactly. You know, see, that's the thing, right? They don't give us any background about him, but I always get the impression that this is basically the job that he now is dealing with in the twilight of his career, meaning he was a detective in some other situation beforehand. But
yeah, and that's why he's able to jump into, like, it's because he's doing the job of, like, a hostage negotiator, you know, and he's the only guy really stepping up to do it, because everyone else is, like, they're scrambling around doing stuff, but he's the one who's really, and everyone's leaving it to him to take charge of it. Like, it's, you know, there's no liaison, there's no diehard, you know, back and forth between, like, this is my job, no, it's not, it's very much like, it's in Garber's hands as this is his responsibility, and he really admirably steps up and does what he's got to do. And again, he is just a man. Like, and you know, he's a Walter Matthau to me is just the perfect casting for that. He's just because he just, you know, they're not going for matinee idol. They're just trying to go for working stiff, doing what he needs to do. And he doesn't complain. And he just gets on with doing the right thing. And it's just like, yeah, I find him a very admirable character. And it just Matthau. It's the type of performance he could do in his sleep. But it's just because he's so good at it, you know. It's just like, yeah, he's perfect in this role. So, and I do think, like, of all the films he's done too, it's like one of the most. It's one of the most thrilling. It's one of the ones, again, I've seen it dozens of times now. So I'm like, when you were mentioning you were doing it, I was like, oh, I 1,000,000% want to come on and talk about film
and
1, 2, 3. So yeah, this is definitely my number one for his.
Excellent. All right. For his Thank work. You for that list. That is a great list. So we will play once again the daily game of Name That Remake. So let's spin the wheel and see what you get. And, you know, around and around the wheel goes, and let's hope it doesn't hit Love Affair.
I mean, if it hits Love Affair now, it's like, oh, great, I know the answer.
That's a good point. It's Love Affair. You do get that you don't really have a problem with that one. That's... okay, like, I can understand how that, how you can look at it from that.
Yeah. But turns out to be, like, which film did Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau remake in 1974? Like, oh, His Girl Friday.
Okay, so this is a movie that originally came out in 1954 and was remade in 1998, and is about a rich man who... decides to plot the perfect murder of his rich wife, who he feels is being unfaithful.
I feel it. Is it a perfect murder with Michael Douglas?
Well, that is the remake.
That's the remake, which is a remake of Dial M for Murder?
That is correct.
I believe.
Very good.
Hey, there we go. We did it, baby.
Nicely done. Nicely done.
I feel you. I feel like you tipped your cards a little bit there by saying the perfect murder. It's like, well, okay, one thing comes to mind when you say that.
Oh, I didn't mean to say the perfect murder. Oh, well, you're right.
I thought you did it intentionally as a little cheeky, no, like, if you don't get this from that, you're going to be kicking yourself.
I was reading the synopsis from IMDb for Dial M for Murder, and I wasn't thinking about the fact that the remake is called The Perfect Murder at the exact same time.
Mm.
Oh, well, what can
you do? I feel like that's a. I guess there was still that dying system though in the 90s. Like, a perfect murder is so much of a duller title. Dial M for Murder is snappy. Like, it sticks with you. Like, a perfect murder is such a kind of. I just have a vague memory of, like, oh yeah, the poster with half of Michael Douglas's face, and yeah, I just remember that being out when, like, Spawn was out and stuff around the same time as well. But yeah. Yeah, okay. It's not the we call the other one that was Daddy's Little Dividends or whatever it was, the Father of the Bride one. Okay.
So why don't you once again tell people where they can find Niall McGowan?
Yeah, well, I'll do a the divide things up. I'll plug something which I believe I mentioned. I don't know if it was on air or if it was in the green room, but of course I'm. As part of Batminute, we do also have a Patreon, and on that Patreon we have, you know, several, like I say several, many, many episodes of random things that me and John have decided to review off the cuff. And, you know, that's also you pay for the Patreon, but also we just do that between seasons of Batminute for free anyway. So you get many episodes for free, such as us covering all the Prince films, Mars Attacks, Joel Schumacher's Phantom of the Opera. Oh, there's tons of stuff out there. But our big thing on Patreon this past year has been Peace Girl Summer, wherein we've interchangeably reviewed every episode of Wednesday, Tim Burton's Wednesday, and Peacemaker, of course, you know, DC character Peacemaker. And we sort of ended up jamming them both together and calling it Peace Girl Summer. And it took over our lives for a little bit because we had to come on and keep doing two episodes a week for ages, which was not originally the intention. It was going to be one a week. And then we're like, oh, Christ, these are both now airing at the same time. And so we had to jump in and do Peace Girl Summer twice a week for about 6 weeks. It was a process we ended up really, really loving and became a whole big thing. And that's why the season of Batman has been a bit delayed, is because, like, oh, we're so deeply entrenched in Peace Girl Summer. I had a great time analyzing the hell out of both those shows, every episode. One of them's definitely better than the other. I won't name names, but, you know, Peacemaker is definitely it's definitely something I would put on much more readily than I would Wednesday. And had a great time with that. And for a mere $2 of... I was going to say your U.S. money, Rob, but you're not living in the U.S.
well, we all use dollars. Like, for, you
know, yeah, but yeah, for two American dollars, or, you know, £1.50 in the UK, I think it is. But you have access to all of Peace Girl Summer now is up there, and we had a great time doing it. I ended up designing a poster for it in the end and everything, even though it's supposed to be a little silly spinoff show. But on top of all that, like in the Patreon too, we've done, like, got dozens and dozens of episodes of other stuff on there. We did an issue by issue breakdown of Batman the Long Halloween and Dark Victory, its sequel. We've done reviews of the Batman 1960s album, where you get to hear Burgess Meredith and Adam West singing and Frank Ocean performing one of the greatest songs I've ever heard in my life about a celebration of just being the Riddler and stuff. Yeah, tons and tons of stuff on there. So if I may, I'll plug the Batman and Patreon, because we just really enjoy doing the work on there. And we're hoping to continue to. I know this upcoming year we're planning to do a mini season reviewing all the Madonna films, tentatively called Madonna or Meh Donna. But we're going to go through and see how bad is her film career, really, because it's regarded as one of the worst, but that'll be going up on the Patreon as well. And hopefully if anyone could spare, you know, $2, $2, well, you know, for a little of that, you'll get the access to all that. So you can at least binge $2 for 1 month. You can binge all of it. Go on, man, go crazy. That is my plug for today.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search. Or Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com, and if you want to send me an email, you can send it to MovieRobMinute@MovieRob.net. So, until tomorrow,
chew! Resume time!